From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Ty Cobb is to this day one of the great names in baseball lore, but he's remembered as much for a long list of terrible character flaws as he is for his brilliance and daring on the field. Yet when our guest today went back into the historical record, all the nasty stories of the vicious player, the bully, the racist, turned out to be one hack writer's fabrication. This hour On Point, setting the record straight on baseball great Ty Cobb. You can join us on air or online. Are you ready to hear the true story about baseball's bad boy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from New York is Charles Learson, former editor at Sports Illustrated, People, and Us Weekly, writer for Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Esquire, and he's out with a new book called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Happy to be here.
Well, Ty Cobb is his baseball royalty, of course. Remind us what an exciting and legendary baseball player he was in his day.
Well, if people know one thing about Ty Cobb as a baseball player, they usually know his batting average, which was 366, which was the highest in his day and is still the record for a batting average. And he did that over the course of 23 and a half seasons. So it's an incredible accomplishment. So they know that about him. But he played in an era before there was, you know, for all practical purposes, before motion pictures. There are movies of him, but there's no whole game films, and so we don't have a sense of him as a player. But one thing I found and was struck by was that it wasn't just the hits. The hits were just the beginning of it, and he'd get 2, 3, 4 a day. But once he got on base is where he really became distinctive. And it wasn't a case of just stealing bases. He would disrupt the proceedings, and he would play with the rhythms of the game to work his way around the bases. Mm.
Here he is in an interview with sports writer Gartland Rice from the early 1930s, Ty Cobb describing his base stealing strategy.
In stealing bases, I always watched the baseman's eyes to know where the ball was coming. His eyes had to watch the ball. I didn't have the time for this, but his eyes told me, and then I knew where to throw my body away from the baseman.
Mm. So not only base stealing, not only his theatrics on the field, he stole home base 54 times more than anybody else. Is that right?
Yes, that's another record of his that still stands. And you know, that's probably the single most exciting play in baseball. And he did it more than anyone else. He did amazing things on the base paths. He once got an inside the park home run on a simple tap back to the pitcher. He turned that into an inside the park home run because there was a guy on third and he got caught in a rundown and Cobb just came flying around. And as soon as that guy got tagged out, he passed him and ran home. He didn't even slide and he scored an inside the park home run. He once stole second, third, and home on 3 consecutive pitches. So you can just, you know, he's often said to have had no sense of humor, but he had an almost kind of Chaplin-esque or Buster Keaton personality as a base runner. You know, he was just fun to watch.
He played in 3 World Series games, set 90 Major League Baseball records, first player ever elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He was also controversial, right? To put it mildly, Charles Learson, tell us about the reputation for aggressive play, sometimes dirty play, and beyond that.
Well, in his day, he had a reputation as a very aggressive player, which was came from the media and came from the sports writers and the fans often. The baseball players, I found, almost to a man, defended him and said he wasn't. He was just playing the game the way it was supposed to be played. And anyone, over and over I heard this mantra that anyone who wears spikes knows that he does not use his spikes in a bad way. But nevertheless, he did have that reputation as an aggressive player. People like that. But in his day, he was just sort of known as an aggressive player and some said a dirty player, but it was all in the context of baseball. The interesting thing about the myth of Ty Cobb is that most of it happened after his death in 1961 and based on no new evidence. It was after his death that his reputation as a racist, a monster, a child hater, a wife beater, I've heard incredible stories. There's no end to them, and people are still making them up and embroidering on them.
Right, and you actually believed the stories, didn't you, Charles Learson, when you first were proposing this book? It was a very different book than the one you actually wrote.
Exactly, Jane. I somewhere in the files of Simon & Schuster, there's a proposal from me that says the exact opposite of what my book says, because I went into this believing the conventional wisdom. I grew up hearing the stories. You know, when you hear baseball stories, often you hear them from your father, and you know, so you trust them, and these are like sacred tales. And I heard that Ty Cobb was a bad guy, and I went in thinking that, and I thought my mission was to, you know, find some fresh examples of him being a monster. But pretty early on in my research, I started to scratch my head and say, wait, this is leading me down a whole different path.
This myth that was proliferated, even recently, Opie and Anthony was a radio talk show featuring Greg Opie Hughes and Anthony and Jim Norton. In June of 2009, they talked about Ty Cobb's reputation for violence and racism.
Was he a wife beater, that Ty Cobb? He was an everything beater. He beat up everything.
Ty Cobb was a horrible racist. Yeah. I think he was a Demerol addict.
Yeah.
He was just not a nice
Sounds
guy.
Sounds fantastic.
And the ball just rolls down the hill, right? I mean, the first biographer, Al Stump, is the one who fanned this reputation initially, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Al Stump inadvertently discovered something that people love. Well, you know, maybe he's not the first to discover it, but people love a monster and they love this story of a villain. And he started to tell his story at a time when we were far enough, the society and the culture was far enough from Ty Cobb's playing days, and the world was changing and eager to hear the dark side of things. That's the only way I can explain it, because Al Stump was not a good writer, but he was a great sensationalist. So he didn't even say that much initially, but he started a snowball rolling, and it's just amazing how people have retold the tale and embroidered upon it in sports bars, and you just heard those guys on the radio doing it. That's going on all the time, and the internet has only sort of supercharged that, and so it goes on all the more. It's a testament to people's love for an evil guy out there, you know.
So to your mind, Ty Cobb deserved a new biography, which is what you wrote.
Well, yeah, I thought he deserved a new biography to begin with, just because one hadn't been written for 20 years before I started The Terrible Beauty. But, when I did find out the real man, I thought I had a problem, because I thought, well, you know, I'm bringing a guy back to the normal range. And then that's usually, you want to make your hero, your protagonist extraordinary. But what I found out was that the man was actually a lot more interesting than the myth.
In what way? In what was the biggest way?
Well, one way was his attitude towards race, actually. He's Al Stump, who started writing these things, didn't ever mention race. In the 1980s, another biographer named Charles Alexander wrote a biography of Cobb that's very well respected, but it gets a lot wrong. I mean, he's got Cobb fighting people that he says are black who weren't black, and they were important fights in Cobb's vast collection of fights. So that really got the racial thing going. And people make assumptions about Ty Cobb because he was born in 1886 in rural Georgia, or semi-rural Georgia, in a small town in Georgia. But what they don't realize is that he's descended from a long line of abolitionists, that his great-grandfather was a preacher who preached against slavery and was driven out of town for it. His grandfather was signed up for the Confederate Army, but was an anti-slavery guy and couldn't fight with the Confederates. His father was a state senator, among other things, who fought for the rights of his black constituents and broke up a lynch mob in town once, and worked as a newspaper editor also for a newspaper that was run by two men who described themselves as abolitionists after the Civil War. So that's the background that Ty Cobb comes from. And he actually said nothing about race. There's nothing on the record about race coming from Ty Cobb until 1953, when he said to the Sporting News, "The Negro should be accepted, and not grudgingly, but wholeheartedly. The Negro has the right to play professional sports, and who's to say he has not?" I get chills every time I hear that and say that, because it has Cobb's chippiness in it, like, who's to say he has not? And it shows what he... you know, what his beliefs were. In 1953, not a lot of Southern players and not a lot of players in general, not a lot of people were coming out that strongly to say wholeheartedly and not grudgingly.
The book is called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. What does A Terrible Beauty refer to?
Well, that's a line from a Yeats poem, and the poem itself doesn't really have anything to do with Cobb, but Cobb's philosophy as a baseball player was to create a mental hazard for the other team. And he said that often, and he thought very much about what he did. He was very much a scientist of the game. And his desire to create a mental hazard made him a sort of a terror on the base paths. And so that's what that was referred to. It. He played a beautiful game, but if you were on the opposition, it was terrible for you.
Here's some sound from a 1994 Ken Burns documentary series titled Baseball. Ty Cobb, voiced by actor Jody Powell, explains his attitude toward baseball.
Baseball is a red-blooded sport for red-blooded men. It's no pink tea. And mollycoddles had better stay out. It's a struggle for supremacy, a survival of the fittest.
Survival of the fittest. Boy, he was smart too, wasn't he? He was a smart player.
He was smart. And by the way, I have to say, I think that quote was made up by Al Stump. Stump, I'll say what Mary McCarthy said about Lillian Hellman, that every word he wrote was a lie, including and the, you know. So, he was that kind of writer. Yeah. But yeah, Cobb did combine fierceness with intelligence, and that's what the beauty of his game was.
We're talking about baseball legend Ty Cobb, looking at his life, his game, and all the myths, many of them very unflattering and, as it turns out, mostly false, surrounding this man. We go out with Sister Winona Carr's 1952 song, The Ball Game. Life is a ball game, but you gotta play it fair. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And everybody can play. Yes, you know Jesus is standing at the home plate. He's waiting for you there. Well, you know life is a ball game, but you've got to play it fair.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at the life of Ty Cobb, a legend of the early days of baseball, who came to be known as a scoundrel after his death in 1961, and a new book about his life that debunks almost every nasty story ever told about him. My guest this hour is Charles Learson, author of the new book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Here's a radio interview with sports writer Gartland Rice, recorded in the 1930s. Ty Cobb saying that he was not a natural talent, even though he led the league in batting when he was only 20 years old. He had to work hard for his whole career.
Baseball to me was more work than play. In fact, it was all work. You see, I was lucky enough to lead the league when I was 20 years old. After that, I wanted to lead it every year. I never thought I was any genius, so I gave up my life to the game for 25 years.
Charles Learson, how was baseball different during the era Ty Cobb played? They called it the dead ball era.
Yeah, that's right, Jane. Baseball was fundamentally different. A lot of people always say baseball is a game that never changes, but that's really not true. It may have looked the same superficially, but it was very different. And a lot of it was because of the ball. The ball was dead. It was not as lively. You couldn't hit it out of the park. You couldn't hit it into the stands hardly. So the players adapted, and Cobb was a classic example of a dead ball era player. His intent was always to kind of poke the ball over the infielder's head. Another player named Wee Willie Keeler said, you know, hit them where they ain't. And that was Cobb epitomized that style of he held a bat in what was called a split hands grip, with his hands separated. And if he wanted to choke up on the bat, he'd move the bottom hand up. And if he wanted to swing away a little bit more, he'd move the top hand down. And he was always adjusting like that and trying to poke the ball into an empty spot. And it was in that way that he got his lifetime batting average and, you know, several times hit over 400. Mm. Baseball then was a very confined thing. It was almost like indoor baseball compared to what we play now, because it was all played. The outfielders stood closer to the infield, and the infielders did what they could, and you got on. There were fewer runs scored, and it was more strategy involved. You got on and you tried to make your way around the bases as best you could, and the scores were lower. The games were faster. Mm. And one very interesting thing is that very often they played with the same ball for all nine innings. And by the time of the ninth inning, the ball would be dirty. Would be some of the pitchers were still spitball pitchers, so they'd be spitting tobacco juice on it. It would be out of shape, and it would be hard to see. You'd be starting to get late in the day, and so that was one of the things you took into account in those days was that by the ninth inning, the ball may not be round anymore.
So the ball was different. The game was different. The audience was different, right? The players' interaction with the fans was different.
Yeah, this is one thing I found fascinating, that we were still, the major leagues, as with American League and National League, didn't happen until 1901, which was 4 years before Cobb came up into the major leagues. So baseball had been around, but this organized form of baseball with everyone going and bringing their families, and that was very new to America, and people didn't know how to act, and they were working out what the protocols were. And one of the things that hadn't been worked out was the fourth wall, that, you weren't supposed to jump on the field if you were agitated and excited. Fans in those days very often violated that invisible wall and ran on the field if they didn't like an umpire's call or they didn't like a player. And they would chase, there's accounts of just the week before Ty Cobb came up to the majors, there's an account of the fans jumping on the field in Detroit, chasing the umpire out into the street. And where he calls, he says it's a forfeit because of the fans. So, and this was a kind of a common occurrence. Alcohol was also a big factor amongst the fans, but also amongst the players. It was a huge problem, and players were often played drunk or seriously hungover. And very often that was figured in the outcomes of games and in their career. And very often it inflamed their emotions. And so there would be a lot more fistfights, a lot more beating up of umpires. One umpire that I found carried a knife because he was attacked so many times by players in those days.
And you actually wrote about these so-called black eye hospitals that some fans and I guess players used in these sort of situations.
You're right. That's in a section where I talk about, I say Ty Cobb got in an awful lot of fights, even in an era when people, the early 20th century was a time when people, meaning men mostly, resorted to throwing their fists a lot faster than they do now. It was just a cultural difference, and there were a lot more more fist fights in those days, just plain and simple. And on the Bowery in New York, I found these examples of, they were called black eye hospitals, where for 5 or 10 cents, you could go in and they would put pancake makeup on your black eye from the barroom brawl you got in next door.
It was a different time, right? Very, yeah, very different. Yeah. A lot of calls here. A lot of listeners want to get in. Let me get Tyrus here first from Piqua, Ohio. Hi, Tyrus. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I thought it was really cool that there's a new book about Ty Cobb that isn't negative. And I just kind of wanted to say real quick that I was named after Ty Cobb.
Uh-huh.
My dad always talked really highly of him when I was a kid.
Very nice, Ty. Thank you for calling. I guess his dad heard the good things, huh, Charles Learson?
Right. Yeah, that's great. The name Tyrus was, as far as I could tell, was an invention of his father. The name wasn't wasn't really a known name in 1886 when he was born. It refers to, might refer to Tyre. In Greek history, the town of Tyre, which put up a fight. Anyway, but and there's a lot of people named after Ty Cobb since.
Here's Tim in Red Oak, Iowa. Hi, Tim. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I know Ty Cobb played through a lot of injuries in his career, and he kind of makes today's ball players look like a bunch of pansies. they get a pulled muscle, and they go on the disabled list. And that's probably a lot of to do with how much money they make. They're like thoroughbred racehorses. They get the slightest thing wrong with them and they take them out of action. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how much money did Ty Cobb make during his career relative to today's players?
Tim, thank you. Gosh, he was very successful, wasn't he, Charles?
He died a millionaire, a multimillionaire, but that came from stock investments, and mostly in Coca-Cola and General Motors and real estate investments he'd made. He was very smart about that, and he tried to tell his sports writers to get in on Coca-Cola, but I say in keeping with the sacred press box ritual regarding the accumulation of wealth, that the sports writers never bought the stock. So, he made in his day, when he started out in 1905, the interesting thing I found was that ballplayers were making less than the average, than the people that were watching them. They were, if you could compare, the average 25-year-old was making more than the average ballplayer, maybe making $1,400 a season or something like that, which even in those days wasn't that much money. I think he made his highest salary ever may have been when he was a manager, and he probably got $30,000 or $35,000 a few years, and that was great, and according to the Times, but it still doesn't adjust the way today's ball players have. And he had to make his money, his real money, off the field.
Back to the inaccuracies of the Ty Cobb story. Talk about his family relations. I mean, there is much truth in the fact that he never had an easy time as a husband or a father. Growing up wasn't easy either, right, Charles?
He had – well, the household seemed to be, by all indications, seemed to be a normal kind of upper-middle-class household in Royston, Georgia. His father was an educator and a newspaper editor. His mother was a traditional mother, Southern mother. But something happened in 1905 where something big happened where his mother shot and killed his father late at night. The father was outside on the – in the yard, and had been coming home from a trip. It's a little unclear. It's not entirely clear whether she thought he was a prowler. That was her story, or whether there was he was checking on her because he believed she was unfaithful. Anyway, it was obviously a very traumatic experience for Ty Cobb. He was 19 years old when it happened. And it's not only did he lose his father, but his mother had killed his father. So he didn't know how to really act towards her. Should he console her? Should he accept consolation from her? And the scandalous part of it about that she may have had a lover that he was checking on, that got into the papers, and that was very traumatic for Cobb. And that happened only a few weeks, two and a half weeks, I think, before he came up to the major leagues. So he was a young man with a lot on his mind in August of 1905 when he first came to Detroit.
What about some of the stories that that Al Stump wrote in his autobiography of there was one about going in and an assault on a groundskeeper and some other things that had happened actually on the grounds, on the property where he lived.
Well, that actually happened at the Augusta Stadium when he was a in spring training where they went there. He played on that team in Augusta as a minor leaguer, but the Tigers had their spring training there. This is a story that has used a lot of people to say that Ty Cobb was a racist, that he beat up a groundskeeper, and then he beat up the groundskeeper's wife when she came to rescue her husband, and it was both of those people were black.
Because this was a story in the Smithsonian, right? This made it to the Smithsonian Magazine.
Well, that story appears in a lot of places. You know, what I found when you start putting all the pixels in place, you find that there was no witness to that fight, and Cobb denied that it happened. The newspapermen saw the groundskeeper drunk approaching Ty Cobb and maybe pushing him or trying to hug him. But the groundskeeper had a reputation around town as a drunkard, and he also had been arrested for wandering into people's houses. He was a harmless guy, but that was his way of going through life. And it gets a little complicated, but it's fascinating when you can tell the story in book length form, because the manager of the Tigers at that time was trying to get Cobb in trouble because he wanted the owner to trade him. The owner was a big Cobb fan. Cobb was a young player, just up about in the major leagues about a year and a half. And he was causing a lot of dissension on the team. And the manager wanted to trade him for another good player. But he wanted him to accumulate a lot of incidents where he got in trouble. So he got the catcher on the team to constantly fight with Cobb and get in fights with Cobb. The catcher's name was Charlie Schmidt. And he kind of sucker punched Cobb on any number of occasions. So when you look at the full record, that's what came out. And none of the newspaper men in that case bothered to interview the black couple. So we don't know what their version of the story was. So, it was a real he said, she said tale in the end, that story.
Charlie Learson, hold on for just a moment. I want to bring another voice into the conversation here. A man you spoke with in the course of your research, he's Herschel Cobb, the grandson of Ty Cobb. He authored his own book about his grandfather, about the man he knew as Granddaddy. His book is called Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather Ty Cobb. He joins us from Menlo Park, California, less than a mile from his grandfather's home. Herschel Cobb, so pleased to have you.
Hello, Jane, and hello, Charles. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Did you grow up believing sort of the standard narrative about your grandfather?
Well, no, not at all. In fact, I grew up in a small town in California, and my father had been dead for some time. He died when I was 8. My mother and my grandfather never got along, so my grandfather's tales or career was hardly ever discussed in our home. And it wasn't until I was 13 years old and just had finished some middle league baseball and was visiting my grandfather in Atherton that I discovered exactly his stature in the world of baseball. I was pretty upset when I visited him because I had been playing baseball and heckled mercilessly to do all kinds of things, and nobody bothered to mention that my grandfather's reputation preceded me. So when I insisted that Granddaddy tell me what he had done, he didn't say anything, but he took me into his office and opened the door and said, "You're going to help me for a while." And he sat me down. I looked around, and there were autographed photos of all the famous baseball players at the time that he played, Babe Ruth, Chris Speaker. There were used bats in the corner, gloves, shoes, plates. Sat me down, and for an hour he signed autographs for youngsters that had written requesting an autograph and baseballs, and my job was to put them into packages and make sure the address was big enough for the postman to read them.
Great memories. So, well, we mentioned Al Stump, your grandfather Ty Cobb's autobiography, much of whose work has been discredited. Much of it was just flat-out false. As a kid, you actually remember Stump trying to get stories out of you about your grandpa, right?
Jane, you are correct. I was 16 and a half that summer, and I'd woken up early. My grandmother was a gardener. She was always up at 5, and I talked her into calling Granddaddy to see if I could come down and visit him early, and he said fine. And when I got there, I recognized Stump's car in the driveway and walked in, and Granddaddy was kind of, he had on his pajama top, his pants on, and it was obviously early, and he hadn't shaved or anything, and Stump was there. And I saw, I said hello to Granddaddy and saw Stump in my grandfather's office going through file cabinets, lifting out pictures. I could see that there were pictures, and I knew that those pictures had autographs on them from famous baseball players, and I mentioned this to Granddaddy, and he yelled at Stump to come out here, and then Granddaddy had to take insulin every day, so his nurse came, took him to his bedroom, and Stump escorted me into the kitchen and started basically trying to pump me for stories of adventures that my grandfather should have had at Lake Tahoe. I mean, he wanted to know about drinking, about going out with women. And Granddaddy never drank at Tahoe with his grandchildren. He took us out to dinner, and we were treated very, very nicely. He hardly had any visitors. Most of the time, we took boat rides around the lake, did fishing. We went, basically what today would be nature walks, but he wanted to show us stuff of the natural beauty of the lake.
So trying to get information that really didn't exist, and you say, I think, that Stump tried to bribe the gardener, is this true, to plant liquor bottles in the trash?
Yeah, that was very funny. It's actually really interesting. My grandmother had a warm spot for Ty Cobb all of her life, even though they were divorced. She truly loved the man. Every time she took me to see him, or the three of us grandchildren to see Granddaddy, she would dress up as if she were going to a garden party. I mean, she had on white gloves and a hat, a lavender dress, perfume, and she's just going to drive us from her home over to 48 Spencer Lane. Anyway, so they shared a gardener, and the gardener was Japanese and had served in the United States in the 442nd Fighting Battalion, which was all Japanese. Granddaddy had Hank 2 days a week, and Grandma had him 3 days a week. And I was there when Hank complained to my grandmother that Mr. Stump was trying to give him money to put some liquor bottles in Granddaddy's trash container so Mr. Stump could find him. And Hank was very, very uncomfortable with that, and was shy enough not to confront Stump, but wanted my grandmother to do it. My grandmother wasn't that type of person, but my Aunt Shirley, Ty's first daughter, was very much like him. I mean, she would take on the world.
And put her foot down, didn't she? I'm sorry to interrupt, Herschel. We got to get the break here. Herschel Cobb is the grandson of Ty Cobb, and will be with us after the break. We're talking about baseball. The grass is green. The boys of summer are back in diamonds all over the country. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for the On Point podcast, sponsored by Audible.com. Many of the books featured on the show, like John Swed's Billie Holiday, The Musician, and The Myth, are available for you to listen to whenever and wherever you wish on Audible.com. It's like having your own personal library with over 180,000 titles that you can enjoy while driving, on the train, just about anywhere. As an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint, and you can get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about baseball then and now, the dead ball era when Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, Shoeless Joe Jackson, and more played hard, played cunning, versus today's game of power and speed. In the 1989 Field of Dreams, Ray Kinsella, played by Kevin Costner, builds a field where the ghosts of past baseball greats come out to play. The ghosts of Shoeless Joe Jackson, played by Ray Liotta, talks to Archie Graham, played by Frank Whaley, a young aspiring ball player who is in awe of the players, but for Joe, they're just old acquaintances.
You wouldn't believe how many guys wanted to play here. We had to beat them off with a stick.
Hey, that's Smokey Joe Wood. And Mel Ott. And Gil Hodges.
Ty Cobb wanted to play. None of us could stand a son of a when we were alive, so we told him to stick it.
My guest this hour, Charles Learson, author of the new book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, and Herschel Cobb, grandson of Ty Cobb, and author of Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather, Ty Cobb. I got a lot of callers to get in here, Herschel, but tell me, what did you make of these terrible accusations, the reputation that morphed after your granddaddy died, him being a racist, a murderer even? How did that strike you? How did that hit you?
Well, you know, I really kind of put it aside because I had a lot of experience with my grandfather every summer, and he was a great grandfather, fun to be with, had a great sense of humor, self-deprecating at times, liked to laugh at himself, was a real student of everything, was always reading three or four books, and I really wasn't bombarded with people coming up and saying, your grandfather did this, your grandfather did that. A lot of people came up and said, you know, your grandfather was the greatest ever. Mm. And I've never given much credence to those. I've done a lot of reading about my grandfather. And also, as I told you, I met Al Stump, and he was really the basis for much of that. So yeah. I really put it aside and haven't been bothered by it.
Let me get Felix in here from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Felix. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, Jane. How are you?
Good. I'm fine, thanks. Go ahead.
My name is Felix. I'm 30 years old. I'm African American. I went to the University of Georgia a long time ago. I'm currently a physician, and I actually received some need-based scholarship money from the Ty Cobb Foundation when I was in college. And I did a quick Google search when I got that scholarship to find out who this guy was. Saw all that stuff about his character flaws, of course, with racism and all. So I'm glad to see that there might be another story to this guy. And even if he happens to be racist and all those bad things about him, at the very least, his family has improved his legacy. And I really appreciate what they've done for me because, you know, where I am today, I probably wouldn't be here as successful without that money.
That's a great story.
So
that's great to hear. You know, he started that fund himself. That wasn't just done in his honor. He started that fund himself, and from the start, it was never, you know, race was never considered. He just wanted to help. He just had to be a kid from Georgia who needed some help to get to college. And, you know, one thing I didn't say before about Cobb's relationship with the other, you know, black people in his life was that he often attended Negro League games after he retired and sat in the dugout with the players. His signature appears on a lot of Negro League balls that were signed by Satchel Paige and young Jackie Robinson and other people like that. And he once threw out the first ball at least once at a Negro League game. He was invited to do it. So the facts just don't jibe with the myth.
Here's Chris in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Chris. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, my point is, I'm in a mixed relationship. My wife is black, and I wanted my kids to know about Black Negro Leagues because they when they played in the 30s and all that, they didn't play against the white players except on barnstorming. You know what I mean? So like, they were barnstorming, and one of my favorites was Cool Papa Bell, James Cool Papa Bell. He's in the Hall of Fame. He would outrun Ty Cobb hands down. And one time they were barnstorming in Cuba, and Ty Cobb was all cocky and all that stuff, and he was talking about, we'll show you how the major leagues do it. Well, if you look into history, it's in the history books. That's how we found it. Ty Cobb batted like 2 for 30-something. And Cool Papa Bell batted like 600 or 700 for the series in Cuba. And so Ty Cobb ended up saying, I'll never play against the Negroes again, the Negro Leagues again. Mm. And to me, I feel like Ty Cobb was great, don't get me wrong, but he didn't play against the best of the best and on an everyday basis. And where would his legacy be if he played against the best? Mm.
Chris, thank
That's
you.
All I'm asking.
Charles Larson?
Well, you know, you could say that one, it's one of the great shames, not just of sports, but of America, that black people were not allowed to play baseball. It sounds absurd, you know, to think about it until 1947 when Jackie Robinson broke the barrier. And it's true of every baseball player has to be taken into consideration that the whole American population wasn't represented and there were no black players, or if you were a batsman like Ty Cobb, there were no black pitchers and no black infielders. And so that's absolutely true. The fact that Cobb said he would never play against black players is not true and is one of those things that comes from the stump and the embroidery, and it just cannot be, you cannot find that quote in the newspaper or any place else where him saying that. So, you know, let's keep things in perspective that it was one of the great shames of America, but when he was asked about it, he took the right position.
Here's David in Tucker, Georgia. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Father's best friend was married to Ty Cobb's niece. I do have a couple of extremely brief Ty Cobb stories. Ty Cobb was out one Saturday with his brother. His brother was a substantial landowner, and they were going to the bank to pick up the money for the week's payroll for his farmhands. And they went to 4 banks, and they were all closed. And the brother thought, well, it must be a very important person's funeral, because that's the only reason these banks would be closed. It turned out there had been a run on the banks, and his brother was broke, and he couldn't even pay his farmhands. And that leads into the other story. His niece, whom I spoke to, visited Ty Cobb when he was dying in Piedmont Hospital here in Atlanta, and there was a big paper sack full of cash with a revolver on top of it in Ty Cobb's room. And the only quote I got from her, from Ty Cobb, was when, at that time, he said, I'm the loneliest man in the world.
David, thank you. Charles Learson, does that sound familiar?
It sounds familiar because it comes from Al Stump, really. I mean, I hate to say it, but I spoke to doctors who were in that room with him. A young doctor who's still alive, quite old now, said there was no gun, there was no money. All that was a lot of bunk. He said, I was there, and Stump wasn't. It's funny how people, you know, put those stories sometimes on family members, and they're told it's really hard to stop the myth from creeping and spreading. But you know, I'm trying to do that with this book.
We like the good guy, bad guy kind of myth perpetuates itself, doesn't it? I mean, something
about
these stories,
fun.
Yeah.
Isn't it more fun to think about an old guy with a big sack of $1 million and a gun on top of it than just an old guy in a bed dying? You know, I mean, so you could see why these stories get told the way they get told.
Here's Henry in Hamden, Connecticut. Hi, Henry. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
It has to do with Ty Cobb's eyesight. And my grandfather told me Ty Cobb never read the newspaper because he didn't want to hurt his eyes. Is that true or false?
That's an interesting question. He believed that reading hurt your eyes. He also believed that movies hurt your eyes, and chewing gum and coffee I don't know how, you know, how much science is behind those beliefs. And so he never went to the movies when he was a player and didn't chew gum and things like that. He couldn't stop himself from reading, though, as Herschel has said. He was a great reader all his life. And once when he was negotiating for a higher salary, he had two negotiating points. One was that he had a small window of opportunity to make money, so he deserved more money. The other was that he had to give up reading novels and other literature because of his eyesight, and so he wanted to be compensated for that. I think he's the first and last baseball player ever to be complain about not being able to read novels.
Pay me to stop reading. Is that right? Right. So based on your study, your research, Charles Lerson, what do you think Ty Cobb would make of baseball today, of the big contracts, of the style of play, the power hitters?
Well, he wouldn't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
and I mean, within certain bounds, he was already complaining about it in the 1950s, and just before he died, he wrote an article for Life magazine, which was the talk of the baseball for a while, and it was complaining about the old days when the guys used strategy and not just swung for the fences, and he had these he talked to Ted Williams, he talked to Joe DiMaggio, who were all part of the modern way of playing baseball, the way it's played today, and he tried to get them to modify their stances and their techniques and all, and he wasn't too happy about that. He saw the beauty of the old dead ball game, and he was espoused that belief till the day he died. Mm.
Babe Ruth said something interesting about Ty Cobb, didn't he? About how Ty Cobb was really quite scary. You could just walk him, Babe Ruth, but boy, you got Ty Cobb on the mound and you were in trouble.
Yeah, well, someone once said that Ty Cobb getting a walk is more exciting than Babe Ruth hitting a home run. Because when Babe Ruth hit a home run, then that was a big thrill and it was over. But when Ty Cobb got to first base, then the fun was just beginning, because he'd start to dance up and down and jabber and make feints and work his way around the bases, in this fashion that was, so much fun to watch.
Herschel Cobb, what's your fondest memory of your granddaddy, Ty Cobb?
Oh, wow. Well, I have a lot of very, very fun memories. I think that the one that happened frequently, and they were kind of similar, was going to visit him, coming into his house in Atherton, and he had a series of questions he asked me about school. What was I reading? What did I like to study? Did I want a cigar? No, thank you. Did I want a beer? No, thank you. And then he'd say, well, go check the freezer and see what you find in there. And I would, and my sister and I would go in there, and we'd haul out, he had gallon jugs of peach ice cream, chocolate, French vanilla, and strawberry, and we'd sit around with these huge spoons and slurp ice cream. that was a lot of fun.
Is it true you remember the scars on his legs, on Ty Cobb's legs, from the spikes of the second baseman?
That was a shocking evening. It was wonderful to, one time prior to driving up to Lake Tahoe, he invited us to stay over night at his house, and I had woken up late in the night, needing to go to the bathroom, walk down the hall, and there was my grandfather in this ridiculously short geometric robe, and I could see his legs, and they were just scar tissue over scar tissue over scar tissue, and that was all created from him sliding feet first into bases and having the baseman jump up in the air and land on his legs with the plates and just kind of dig in as if to say, don't ever try this again. And he survived that. Clearly, it took a toll on his body, but it was a harrowing vision that I have implanted in my memory bank. But it also opened the door to sitting on his lap and giving him a big hug.
Part of the Ty Cobb lore, Charles Lerson, was these stories of Ty Cobb being notorious for sliding into bases feet first, his spikes high and sharpened. I mean, whether or not that's true, he did have 9 different ways of sliding into base, did he not?
He did, and he was an artist at it. The idea, Jane, of sliding into base, you want to give the infielder as little to tag as possible, as little to touch as possible. So you want to do these fadeaway slides he did in those days, and these feints and these fancy slides. he did, you know, what makes baseball interesting is he also had this belief, though, that he had the right of way right in front of the base. And the baseman backed him up on this to a man. If you read in my book, I've got quote after quote after quote of baseman saying, yes, he's entitled to that patch in front of the base. And if you decide you're going to stick your arm down there, your hand, your foot, whatever, then you just have to take the consequences. But he's not going to go out of his way to barrel into you. He's going to try to go out of his way to avoid touching you and all. Mm-hmm. So you know, and there's a very famous picture of him. He seems to be jumping into a catcher, a guy whose name is Paul Critchell, that's often held up. But really, he deftly knocked the ball out of the catcher's hand. The ball went to the backstop, and he was safe. So there was a beauty in this fury, and it wasn't violence, and it wasn't meanness.
Is it true Ty Cobb was instrumental in helping Joe DiMaggio negotiate his rookie contract with the Yankees?
That's right. Somehow, because he was out in California and Joe DiMaggio was there, and Joe DiMaggio was known as an upcoming star, he got in touch with him. And Joe DiMaggio, you know, in those days, he didn't have agents yet. He was writing a letter to the Yankees, and he said, no, don't accept that. And he gave him, told him what to say. He sent it back, and he got a higher offer. He showed it to Cobb. Cobb said, no, don't accept that either. Write another one. So he wrote another letter. And then when that second letter came back, it said, this is our final offer, and stop showing these letters to Cobb. It said, you know.
Just a couple minutes left here, Charles Learson. If you were lucky enough to interview Ty Cobb, what would you ask him?
I would ask him what he dreamed about when he went to bed at night, you know, because I kind of, after 4 years of research, you know, I know a lot about him, but there's a part of him that he kept secret, you know. And another grandchild of his, Peggy, said to me, you know, he pushed people away, and yet he wanted to be close to them. So I would ask him about that and resolving that. He was a challenging guy to know, but he wasn't a bad-hearted guy at all.
Anyone out there in Major League Baseball today that reminds you of him?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Jose Altuve from Houston and D. Gordon for the Marlins. I think I saw a quote from Cole Hamels, the pitcher, said, when D. Gordon is on, you have to worry about two people, the batter and D. Gordon. And that's exactly the Ty Cobb philosophy. He's giving you more to worry about than you had a minute ago.
What a wonderful hour. Terrific memories. Herschel Cobb, grandson of Ty Cobb and author of Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather Ty Cobb. Thanks for so much for being with us, Herschel. Really appreciate your stories.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Charles Learson, author of the new book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you, Jane. It's been fun.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, everybody on the dance floor, how electronic dance music conquered America. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.